This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and we are just days away from what many are calling a cosmic event of a lifetime, a total solar eclipse. For the first time in 99 years, people in the United States from coast to coast can see what happens when the moon completely covers the sun. In under 3 minutes, those in the path of totality are expected to catch glimpses of Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Jupiter. They may also witness other odd phenomena on Earth, like changes in plant and animal behavior. The scientific world is abuzz as well. NASA is readying B-57 bombers and balloons to use for real-time research. At the same time, local officials in western North Carolina are a little more on edge as they prepare for an unprecedented number of visitors. They're suggesting that locals stock up and stay put during the eclipse. We'll talk about all of that today as we're joined by eclipse chasers, scientists, and more. Joining me first is Amy Sale. She's an educator with the Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center in Chapel Hill. Amy, welcome to State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Let us start with the basics. What is a solar eclipse? How is it different from a lunar and other eclipses that we might be familiar with?
So a solar eclipse happens when the moon appears to pass in front of the sun and casts a shadow on Earth. And if you are standing in the moon's shadow, you get to experience the eclipse. And a lunar eclipse is a different lineup. That lineup happens when the moon appears to pass in the Earth's shadow.
So why don't we, the moon, the Earth, they're moving all the time around the sun. Why doesn't this happen more often?
Right. The moon orbits the Earth about once a month or once a month, if you want to call it that. And so you would think at every new moon, when the moon passes between Earth and the sun, you might get a solar eclipse. And at every full moon, that you might get a lunar eclipse. But it doesn't work that way because the moon's orbit around Earth is tilted by about 5 degrees with respect to the Earth's orbit around the sun. So you end up, the net result is you only have about a couple of times a year where you have the potential for solar and lunar eclipses.
And yet, it is a rare event indeed. The last one, at least for the continental United States, was, 99 years ago when we saw this kind of thing?
Well, there was one in 1979 that was visible in the Pacific Northwest mm-hmm. as a total solar eclipse. But yes, continent crossing, it has been since 1918.
Now, the other thing that I wonder about is the moon, obviously much smaller than the sun, no matter what it looks like when you look in the sky. So how is it possible for the moon to cover the sun?
Right. It seems like it should be impossible. The sun is 400 times bigger across than the moon, but it also happens by cosmic coincidence to be about 400 times farther away.
Uh-huh.
So they have about the same apparent size in the sky, and the moon can sometimes completely cover the sun.
So now what kind of views are we going to, we're talking about the fact that this is the coast-to-coast solar eclipse that we're going to see across the United States. What about North Carolina? What views are visible and possible here in this state?
It's going to be a lot different depending on where you are. If you are lucky enough to be in that path of totality, the southwestern part of North Carolina, and let's keep fingers crossed for clear skies that day, you will have a very different experience from those who stay only where it's partial. And even Asheville in its 99%, that's only a partial solar eclipse. A lot of the sun will be covered up, no matter where you are in North Carolina. In the Triangle area, it's about 93% eclipsed at 2:43 p.m. And by the way, this is an event that goes on for more than just a couple of minutes. The partial eclipse starts in the Triangle area about 1:15 p.m. Your mileage may vary elsewhere in the state and ends at 4:05 p.m.
So you'll start noticing things, and if you were able to look up, you'll start to see some of that over a course of that number of hours, but the totality. That's the thing that lasts a couple of minutes. Why is it? What's the big difference between 99% and 100%?
Right. You'd think, 99% eclipse, that'll be 99% of the full experience. But it's not. I think people will be surprised to discover just how much sunlight 1% of sunlight is. So I urge anyone who's able to get themselves to the path of totality. I suspect that those who stay where it's only partial are going to wonder afterwards what all the hype was about. But those who go to totality, they'll know.
Well, I think if you go to totality, the eclipse will actually be the number of human bodies between you and the sky. So
yeah.
you may not get to see the eclipse, but I take your point. So what should we do? Talk about preparations. How can we look at the sun? How do we prepare ourselves for this?
Right. So It might be difficult and challenging to get eclipse glasses at this point, but they're a great way that you can use to look at the sun if you have them or if you know somebody who's willing to share. You can use eclipse glasses and use them to look at the sun directly. And what it'll look like is between, again, for triangle area, between 1:15 and 4:05 p.m., it'll look like the sun has a bite being taken out of it. But if you don't have eclipse glasses or you're concerned that you accidentally bought some that are not legitimate, you can use another method called pinhole projection. And this is an indirect method, and so it's really important to understand pinhole projection does not mean looking through a pinhole at the sun. It's an indirect method. Your back is to the sun, and it can be really simple. You can use two index cards, punch a hole in one, and basically the light of the sun passes through the small opening, and then you project it onto another card or onto the ground. Or you can use a colander. And those little holes act like pinhole projectors. Or you can look on the ground underneath at the shadows of the leaves on the ground. The little spaces between leaves on a tree can act like pinhole projectors. And we've had a number of people, that's their memory of previous partial solar eclipses, is seeing all those images of eclipse suns on the ground. You can even use your fingers.
And it has the value of seeing whatever changes happen in the natural world, should there be any. You're looking right at it.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. That's good. And is there a test for knowing whether or not I've got some bogus glasses? Because it would be important to know if I've got the real thing. Is there a test?
Well, there's if you bought them directly from one of the reputable manufacturers, you should be good. If you got them at the Moorhead Planetarium gift shop, they're legitimate. It's worth taking a little time. Anybody who's feeling unsure, go to either the NASA or the American Astronomical Society website, and they have a section on eye safety, and they go through a fairly good detailed explanation of kind of how to get a sense of whether your eclipse glasses are good or not. When you use eclipse glasses to look at the sun, you should see only the sun.
Mm. Yeah, but it may be too late by then, but I take your, so that's very helpful, and that stuff will be at our website, how to find that stuff. I want to bring Greg Redfern into the conversation now. He's a former astronomy professor at NASA JPL Solar System. Right now he's an ambassador for that program. And Greg Redfern, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much, and hello, North Carolina.
This is not a once-in-a-lifetime event for you. You, in fact, witnessed a total solar eclipse in 1998. Tell us about your experience.
I did. As a matter of fact, I'm wearing a shirt that commemorated the February 26, 1998 total solar eclipse that happened down in the Caribbean off of Curaçao. And I was with a Sky and Telescope staff, and we had a three-ship fleet to see this beautiful totality, and it was my first total solar eclipse ever. And once you have been in the umbra or the moon shadow, you are never the same. You become an umbraphile, and it was amazing. And I did some work with Sue Palka, our local weather person. She got the film back in time for the 10 o'clock news. Not an easy feat in 1998 when everything was tape, not digital.
Yes, I remember those days. And also you're on a boat. You're in the ocean. I mean, how cool is that?
It was wonderful. The nice thing it gives you is the advantage of, say, clouds are coming in. You can chart a course to try and get out from the clouds. And we had to reposition a little bit. But once that came in, the thing that I would say is different than a land eclipse is that because you have a flat surface of the ocean, you can really see that motion of the umbra coming in at you about 1,700 plus miles an hour to envelop you. And out of that 70-mile-wide path, you have daylight outside of where you are in the shadow, and that is an experience to remember.
So you have a sense of it happening quickly. It happens kind of fast in some ways.
Too fast, too fast. There's no such thing as too long of totality.
Well, what's the scientific significance of this? What are you looking for in these eclipses?
This eclipse is unique for several reasons, and I'll say this up front. It's probably going to be the most observed eclipse in U.S. and world history. But for astronomers and physicists, this gives us an opportunity to study the sun for an extended period of time. When the moon shadow makes landfall over Oregon and goes across the continental United States during that four-hour-plus period and exits off of South Carolina, NASA has planned 11 scientific projects to study the sun. We're going to study the planet Mercury. We're going to do some things regarding the Earth in terms of atmosphere. And they really are interesting experiments because with this availability, we can track changes in the sun's outer atmosphere that we call the corona. And if I may, just a little bit on the sun. When we look at the sun, and like Amy says, through our safe and approved solar eclipse glasses, what you are seeing is the surface of the sun. It is not a solid body. It is a hot, gaseous body, but it's still, we call it the surface. And that's about 8,000 degrees or so. But only during a total solar eclipse from the ground when we observe it can we see what we call the sun's corona. This is the outer atmosphere of the sun that extends just above the surface of the sun beyond what we call the chromosphere, which people can see in an eclipse and with special telescopes. But the corona extends out into space, and the temperature grows from that about 8,000 to 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit to 1 million degrees Fahrenheit.
It's hotter at the edges than in the middle?
It is. It is not a constant temperature. Hmm. It does have some variability, but it's still very, very close to that 1 million degrees.
Wow.
And scientists don't know why this happens.
Yeah, I would.
Some theories.
Well, I'm going to take a break there, get to those theories, because you just surprised me. I would have thought the closer you are to the surface, the hotter it'd be. And then as you get out into space, it gets cool. So we're going to find out more about that and much, much more. I want to thank Amy Sale, first of all, an educator at the Moorhead Planetarium in Chapel Hill. Amy, thank you for being on our program.
Thank you very much.
Greg Redfern is going to stay with us, a solar system ambassador for NASA, and you will be with us too, I hope, on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking about the total solar eclipse traversing America next week. Millions of people have secured their eclipse glasses and are making plans to be within the path of totality to catch this spectacular cosmic view. Still with us is Greg Redfern. He's with the NASA Solar System Ambassadors Program. And just before the break, you told me that the corona, outer edge of the sun that kind of goes off into space, is actually significantly hotter than the surface of the sun. Do we know? I mean, that surprises me. Tell me more.
Well, Frank, the interesting thing is the corona has an inner corona and an outer corona. We can observe the outer corona using spacecraft in space that have a special device that blocks the sun. So we can kind of see the outer corona. But it is only during total solar eclipses that we can see the inner corona, which is closest to the sun. So out of these 11 science projects that NASA's got going, six of them deal specifically with the sun, and a lot of them have to deal with the corona. There is for the first time ever, a prediction that is out of what the corona is going to look like during this eclipse. Using supercomputers, they were able to model what they think it's going to look like. So we'll see, are they accurate with their models? We're also going to be observing the corona with those B-57 aircraft you talked about, and they're going to be at 50,000 feet, moving about 480 knots or so, and because of their motion along the path, taking off from Houston, Texas, and flying along the center line through several states, they are going to extend the length of time of totality so that the special telescopes and instruments they have in their noses will be able to gather more data about the corona from their unique position.
So they
That's
kind of
really
stay
cool.
They can kind of stay with the totality, or at least pretty close to it, and kind of lock
would
in.
Would you believe for up to 8 minutes?
Wow. Well, that's
so they,
a lot longer than the rest of us.
It's pedal to the metal up there at 50,000 feet, and they're going to be flying in tandem.
Hey, tell us about observing Mercury. Again, this is another question that I had. I mean, you can now have a better view or a different kind of view of Mercury during the eclipse. And I thought to myself, well, why not just look at night? I mean, what's the difference?
Well, the thing is, Mercury, anybody that's ever tried to photograph it or see it, it's always close to the sun, and looking through the Earth's atmosphere, it looks like it's swimming in water. It's a tough target. So we had the NASA Messenger mission that was around Mercury for several years, which is now it's inactive. But for this eclipse, those B-57s are going to be, once they're finished with totality, Frank, they're going to take the same instrumentation and they're going to turn over to observe Mercury. The whole idea is to observe Mercury with the sun's light being blocked out in the infrared portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, so they can measure subtle temperature differences on the surface of Mercury and help refine what our knowledge is of the composition of the planet closest to the sun.
See, I would have
hardly wait for the results.
Well, me either, but I would have thought that we were able to digitally filter that so that we could kind of look and then filter out the stuff we didn't like when we look at a place like Mercury.
But you still have to go through the Earth's atmosphere when you're on the ground, and that's a tough deal. So with the aircraft at 50,000 feet, they're above 90% of the Earth's water vapor, so that helps in the infrared spectrum, and also the clarity of the atmosphere is going to be such that they can get those precise measurements that they need. Pretty impressive mission.
That is. It's very cool stuff. I want to bring Helen Chickering into the conversation now, who is a reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio News in Asheville and has been reporting on the way communities in Western North Carolina are preparing for the eclipse. Helen Chickering, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Frank.
We've been talking about some of the science behind this eclipse and what we're looking forward to in terms of research discoveries. Scientific events taking place in Western North Carolina also tied to the eclipse. I know you reported on Southwestern Community College in Silva and its participation in NASA's Eclipse Ballooning Project. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so Southwestern Community College is one of two North Carolina colleges that will participate in the NASA Eclipse Ballooning Project. So 50 balloon teams will be stationed along the path of totality from Oregon down to South Carolina. They will launch high-altitude balloons capturing video and images of the eclipse from space as it moves across that path. And those images will be live-streamed on NASA's website for public viewing. So it's cool if you can't see the eclipse or you're not in a good viewing spot, you can see it online.
Oh, that's great. And I understand this project has also helped Southwestern Community College's STEM program. Is that right?
Absolutely. So SEC is the only community college in the country to have a STEM collaborative agreement. And this balloon project has just launched excitement. Their physics professor, Matt Cass, has actually gone back to school this summer to beef up, get some extra astronomy courses so they can beef up their program. There are a number of students who will graduate and go on to get their four-year degree with hopes of working for NASA. The excitement is just exploding. They will actually be in Anderson, South Carolina, launching at about 1:30 in the afternoon. Lenore Ryan will actually be at Pisgah Astronomical Research Institute outside of Brevard, launching sometime right around that time.
Tell us about that, because I know there are events going on at Pisgah, the Pisgah Astronomical Research Institute.
Yeah, that's a hidden gem. And you know what? Even natives to this area don't know much about it. It's called Perry, and it was a NASA tracking station following the Gemini and Apollo space programs. It's near Brevard in Rossman, North Carolina, in the middle of the Pisgah National Forest. So you go down this windy road and boom, 200 acres, giant telescopes and satellites. Visually super, super cool.
Low light pollution.
Yeah, low light, beautiful. It's absolutely, and they've got lots of viewing stations. Anyway, so they're hosting a huge viewing event. More than 1,000 people are expected, including NASA scientists. They will use optical and radio telescopes to study the eclipse. And so the good news for that is, even if it's cloudy, those radio telescopes can capture information. They're going to study the sun's atmosphere, focusing on hydrogen in the sun's atmosphere. And then they'll have NASA educators giving talks, all kinds of events. It is sold out, just so you know.
Oh, Greg Redfern, let me ask you, with NASA's Solar System Ambassadors Program, how important it is? It seems to me that there's a lot more citizen science going on these days, and a lot more participation around the country contributing to the science of for the pros. Am I right about that? Is there a lot more of that going on this time?
Frank, you're dead on with that. If you go to the NASA.gov website, there is a link that you can click on that's the entire Eclipse 2017. There is a whole section devoted to citizen science. And NASA has gotten amateur astronomers, train them on how to take images of the sun during totality to get that corona, and that will allow the collection of data all across the United States in the path of totality that they can use to look at what was the view of the corona during this 4-hour time frame. Then they're also asking people to take atmospheric observations during the eclipse, especially totality. What's the temperature? What's the humidity? What's the wind? So we're also studying Earth's atmosphere. So you can categorize this as looking at Earth's weather, looking at the sun, the corona, and also what's the effect on the Earth's atmosphere with regard to changes caused by totality. Does it affect the ionosphere, which is where we transmit GPS signals through it to hit the surface of the Earth? Does it affect our Earth's atmosphere? It's pretty neat.
Cool.
And on your question about solar system ambassadors, this was a program that NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory started back in the late 1990s, following upon the success of all their missions. They just didn't have enough people out there to provide information to the public about what's going on in space and the solar system. So the Solar System Ambassador Program was started with bringing in volunteers who are vetted and then trained to be able to go out to their local communities and share the excitement of solar system exploration, things like totality, things like meteor showers. And you've got them in North Carolina as well. So if you go to NASA Solar System Ambassador in your search engine, click it up, you can learn all about your ambassadors there in your state of North Carolina.
Well, apparently it's working because there's quite a crowd getting ready for this this eclipse. Helen,
you know,
Greg was talking about the terrestrial effects of this, and I know that there's an event taking place in Western North Carolina Nature Center in Asheville where people are invited to observe the animals during the eclipse. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, this is a great citizen science project, especially for those of us in Asheville. We're at 99% totality, but you can watch the sky, right? And then you can look at nature right around you. The Western North Carolina Nature Center is hosting an eclipse animal observation event. They're inviting the public to observe one of 60 native species during the eclipse. They'll pass out sheets. You can record those observations. That will be shared with iNaturalist, which is a really cool citizen and Science Project, an online social network. It's a giant open source database for researchers and the public. And the cool thing is anybody can participate. So you can download the app on your phone and you can observe even in your backyard. But they're hosting a dual viewing event. So look up at the sky, they'll pass out glasses and then observe nature and see what the animals around you do. You know, there are all kinds of bizarre animal stories, but they do know that animals tend to behave like it's nighttime.
Yeah, and I guess this is one of the differences between total eclipse and 99%. You won't get quite the same effect. Roosters may not start crowing at the end of the eclipse the way they would sort of in totality, I guess. But a lot of fun things to watch with animals. People apparently asking what will happen to their dog. Big question, apparently.
Yeah, lots of people are asking. We're getting lots of calls about should I worry about my animal looking up to the sun? Should I keep them indoors? And sort of the general thinking is, humans are much more curious about the eclipse. We all want to look up, but animals tend not to do that. So
they'll all be looking at the humans in those glasses
exactly,
and wondering why
exactly.
They're on the, you know, the Blue Ridge Parkway out of gas and texting their friends about what a miserable experience they're having because there's so many people there. Speaking of the so many people, you're in Western North Carolina, Helen. What's it like there, or was it going to be like? I guess what are people being warned about?
So the best reaction I've heard so far came from the mayor of the town of Andrews, Nancy Curtis, which is smack in the middle of the path of totality, about 1,500 people. She told our reporter, Davin Eldridge, who was covering a town meeting, quote, "We could get anywhere from 10,000 to Woodstock." So you have to remember, you know, Western North Carolina is used to the constant ebb and flow of tourists, but this is like the Super Bowl, so a concentrated one-day event, lots of buildup. You've got an idea of the crowd, the fans who bought tickets, in this case, made hotel reservations for a ticketed eclipse event. Then there's the unknown, the unticketed tailgaters, right, that are just going to show up last minute. Weather will probably affect those numbers. Right now it's looking pretty good, sunny skies and highs in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Tips for drivers, don't wear your glasses while you're driving.
That's my favorite. So patience, leave early, take alternate routes, have a full tank of gas, pack snacks and activities for the kids. So really think of it like that Super Bowl event. be prepared to hang out in the parking lot to and from and just sort of enjoy the ride. We do know that message boards along the highway will display Eclipse parking and traffic updates. They are suspending construction in this area on Monday, and construction crews will help with traffic flow. That's with the Highway Patrol. And the parkway, weather permitting, will be a great place to be, but you also have to be careful because they're asking drivers not to pull over on the side unless you are at a designated overlook, which will probably fill up pretty quickly.
Don't take pictures while you're driving.
Yes.
Here's why I'm not worried that people are going to wear their glasses while they're driving, because they won't be able to send texts. They won't be able to see. That's why they won't do it. Well, listen, many across the state of North Carolina are indeed preparing to witness their first total solar eclipse. But for my next guest, eclipse watching has become somewhat of an obsession. David Barron is a former public radio reporter who has witnessed five total solar eclipses, recently authored the book American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. David Barron, welcome.
Hello, Frank. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk with you. You are a self-proclaimed umbrophile, someone who loves eclipses. So for you, not a once-in-a-lifetime event. Tell us a bit about your first experience and what got you going on this.
Well, interestingly, my first eclipse was the same one that Greg was talking about. He was off of Curacao. I was on the island of Aruba. And I went down there in 1998 thinking that this would be an interesting intellectual experience. You know, I was a science journalist and I wanted to see what a total solar eclipse was about. Well, it was the most awe-inspiring, emotional, and I dare say spiritual experience I had ever had. It just was mind-blowing. And I decided I just needed to experience it again. So a total solar eclipse occurs somewhere on Earth, usually about once every 18 months, often someplace very hard to get to. And so when I can afford to go see one in some place where it will be a reasonable chance of clear skies, I will go.
And you have, so you've seen five. Does it get to, now, what about the first one? Of course, you weren't expecting much. You thought it was an intellectual experience, your duty as a science reporter to go see one of these. Have this, what you described as a spiritual experience. Does it wane at all in number two, number three, number four? Does it change as you've seen many?
Well, interesting you should ask that. Each one is different. I mean, and you might also ask, well, why go see more than one? I mean, you know, because aren't they all the same? And they're all different. The corona, the solar corona, which is the most beautiful thing you have ever seen in the sky. It looks like a wreath woven out of tinsel. It just shimmers out there in space. Well, the corona is different every time. It's sort of like the sun has a different hairstyles because it looks like hair coming off the sun. So the corona is different. You'll see different planets at different eclipses. Some get very dark. Some don't get quite as dark. Some I've seen with hundreds of thousands of other people. I was in Munich in 1999, and that was a fantastic experience. Others I've seen virtually by myself up in the North Atlantic in the Faroe Islands. So each is different. I do think the first one for me will always be special because it rewired my brain. It just taught me where I stand in the universe in a way that I will never forget.
Well, tell us now about your book, because in that book you chose to focus on the eclipse of 1878. Tell us more.
So July 29th, 1878, a total solar eclipse visited the western reaches of the United States, the Wild West. The path of totality that year was from Montana Territory down to Texas. And I tell you, the United States had pretty much the exact same experience then that we're having now. People knew it was coming. The public was really excited about it. There were eclipse tourists who headed out to Denver. The hotel rooms were full. People sold eclipse glasses on corners. Now, eclipse glasses back then would not be safe by modern standards, but people took pieces of clear glass and smoked them over flames so they got really dark. And it was a really, really important event for science. There were dozens of great scientists who traveled out to the Wild West to study the eclipse, and among them was Thomas Edison. He was an eclipse chaser. In 1878, he went to Wyoming to study the solar corona. So it was an event that people got excited about as a spectacle, and it also was a really important event in just getting America excited about science and inspiring us to become a global superpower in science a few decades
later. Tell us more about that, because it really is a snapshot of that period in American and kind of Western history and where America, the United States of America, stood in the eyes of the world in terms of scientific research. We were struggling to be recognized, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, 1878, we had just turned 100 years old a couple years before. We were an adolescent nation. We were growing rapidly in population and economic might, but Europe, frankly, looked down their noses at us in terms of anything intellectual. Europe was the center of Western culture, and Europe was the center of science. But there was a small band of American scientists who were determined to show Europe that we were competitors. And so in 1878, when all these scientists headed out to the Wild West to study the eclipse, this was our eclipse. This was in our backyard, and we were going to show the world what we could do. And, it's sort of like the moon landing in the 1960s. It was this moment for the nation to come together around science. In a democracy, it's the general public that controls what our country is going to do. And it was important to have an event to get the general public excited about science as a shared national goal.
We will talk more about the cultural significance of eclipses with David Barron, the author of the new book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. He will stay with us. I want to thank Greg Redfern, a NASA JPL Solar System Ambassador. Greg, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you, Frank. And just one quick note. People need to tune in to NASA.gov during that four-hour time frame, because they're going to be carrying live the coverage from Oregon to South Carolina, including the International Space Station. So I hope they'll tune in.
Or tune in to Blue Ridge Public Radio, where Helen Chickering is a reporter. Helen, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you so much, Frank. It was a pleasure.
More about the cultural significance in the past and today of solar eclipses when our program continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. In just 4 days, many people across North Carolina will turn their bespectacled heads skyward to witness a total solar eclipse. The event presents some things from happening, like you getting to the place you're going because of the traffic, but it presents also a unique research opportunity for scientists and everyday citizens, and there are many who are also looking at it as a cultural phenomenon. Still with us is David Barron, former public radio reporter, who recently authored the book American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. And before the break, we were talking about the eclipse of 1878, which you focus on in your book. And you were talking about Thomas Edison, who really was kind of at the beginning of his career when this eclipse took place. This is an important moment for him as well. He contributed to our understanding of eclipses, but also the eclipse itself and his contribution contributed to his rise to fame, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so the eclipse of 1878 occurred at a key moment in Thomas Edison's life. He was just 31 years old, and he had just before the eclipse come out with the phonograph, and that was the invention that launched Thomas Edison to global fame. He suddenly, he was one of the very first global celebrities. The newspapers couldn't get enough of Edison. He was hailed as this genius. And so when Edison announced that he was going out to Wyoming for the eclipse of 1878, that really heightened America's interest in the eclipse, which was already pretty high. And in fact, there was a reporter from the New York Herald who followed Edison out kind of as an eclipse correspondent to see what Edison was up to. Well, as soon as Edison returned from Wyoming, in fact, the very next day after he returned to New Jersey, he started work on a new project, and that was the incandescent light. So and actually there are interesting ways in which his eclipse expedition contributed to the success of the light bulb. So 1878 is just a key year in the life of Thomas Edison, and his journey out to Wyoming to show that he was not just an inventor is a little known aspect of his life.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point too, because later in his career, of course, he kind of poo-pooed technical science or formal science and sort of took on this kind of rough and ready approach to an invention and that sort of thing. But that moment in his career, he really wanted the respect of the academy, right?
That's a very good point, because if you read most any biography of Edison, you'll read that he was adamant that he was not a scientist. He was an inventor. But that's the older Edison who believed that. The young Edison who went to Wyoming actually wanted to be respected as a scientist. He wanted to discover just basic information about how the world works. And he wanted the respect of academic scientists. And so when he traveled to Wyoming for the eclipse, he was in the company of several professors. And he came up with a device, something called the tazimeter, which was a very sensitive heat detector that he was going to use to study the solar corona, to see if it gave off heat as well as light. And so this was Edison's attempt to be an astronomer.
Now, 1878, also the beginning, the earliest days of the feminist movement in the United States. And you tell the story of Mariah Mitchell. Tell us about her.
Well, so as I said, there were dozens of scientists who went out to Wyoming, Colorado, Texas to be in the path of totality. Almost all of them, of course, were men, because almost all scientists in that era were men. But Mariah Mitchell, who taught astronomy at Vassar College, which at the time was a newly founded all-women's college, she was determined to open the doors of science to women. And so at this time, when all of these male scientists were being invited out to the West and being given grants by the federal government to go out West, and she was excluded, she took it upon herself to put together an all-female expedition to Denver for the eclipse. And it was just a sensation in the press. She got a lot of very positive feedback for showing that women could be strong and intelligent and scientifically minded. And there's this wonderful photograph in my book of the Vassar College eclipse party, these women in Victorian dresses sitting beside their telescopes waiting for the eclipse.
And you point out in your book there was quite a bit of pushback against the idea that women should be involved in education or science at all. One particular infamous book that came to popular attention at the time.
Yeah, I know people always think I'm exaggerating, but I tell you I'm not. In the 1870s, there was a widespread belief that if a woman used her brain too much, it actually was bad for her health. And this book that came out in 1873, written by a Harvard doctor named Edward H. Clark, argued that if a young woman, while she was maturing, if she went to college, that using her brain would actually sap energy from her reproductive organs, and she would become a sterile, masculine invalid. And this was what Mariah Mitchell was up against. And so her eclipse expedition, showing that women who were educated were also healthy and feminine, this was really important in showing the American public that Dr. Clark's book was, frankly, rubbish.
Your book looks at eclipses and the cultural phenomenon as well as the scientific realm. And, of course, again, this kind of pivotal moment in American history, 1878. What kind of cultural impact do you think that the 2017 eclipse might have?
I think it could be quite significant. And actually, there are some really interesting parallels between 1878 and today. I mean, first of all, 1878 was a time when America was politically divided. In fact, we had just recently elected a president, Rutherford B. Hayes, a Republican, who lost the popular vote but won the Electoral College. The summer of 1878, Congress was holding hearings into electoral fraud. The Democrats were calling Rutherford B. Hayes his fraudulency. I mean, we were a divided country. But we came together around the eclipse. It was this shared moment just for everyone to get excited. And I think the same thing will happen today. It is not going to solve our political problems. But when was the last time we had a true national event that everyone was focused on that wasn't political and that wasn't some tragedy, wasn't some school shooting or terrible natural disaster? And so I do think there's an opportunity for a little bit of national healing. And also, the path of totality, you know, goes right over mostly red states. And a lot of people from blue states or blue regions of red states are moving into the path of totality to see the eclipse. And it can't do anything but help for us just to come together and remember we're all human beings and we're all Americans, and to share something positive.
All right, David, I'm going to hold you to that.
Please do.
We have been talking about this purely through the lens of a kind of a European history and the way in which it has been understood, totality and solar eclipses. But, of course, solar eclipses have cultural and religious significance for many indigenous people. And in western North Carolina, the Eastern Band of the Cherokee will celebrate the eclipse with drumming, storytelling, and music. The Museum of the Cherokee Indian is planning an event, which starts at 2 p.m. on Sunday and continues on Monday. And joining me now is Michael Crow, a Cherokee Friends manager at the museum. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for having me today.
Sure thing. Also with us is Barbara Duncan. Barbara is the museum's education director, also a professor of Cherokee language at the University of North Carolina, Asheville. Hello, Barbara.
Hello, Frank. Thanks for including me.
My pleasure. Mike, tell us what you have planned for the Moments of Totality. Is there what happens then, and what are you planning to do?
Well, there are, as you just mentioned, many events planned for the day of and also the day prior. But at the Moment of Totality, they've asked me to share the story of the frog eating the sun.
Tell us that story.
We're very aware of celestial happenings, and it's very much ingrained in our material culture, as it is our oral tradition. But there is a story concerning eclipses in general, and it talks about when the sun or the moon is eclipsed, it's because the great frog has come up from the underworld and is trying to swallow the sun.
Sure.
Everybody knows this.
So it's a commonly told story and a commonly understood story. Were there events and activities that would take place, generally speaking, during an eclipse?
Yes. They said when the frog would swallow the sun, then in more ancient times, then the people would come out and bang the drum or make loud noises. And after a time, this would frighten the frog away, and everything would basically go back to the way it was normally.
Barbara, give us a sense of how the Cherokee see the sun and these sort of cosmological events in terms of daily life and what role that relationship plays among the Cherokee.
Well, in the traditional old-time view of things, the sun was part of the upper world, and we human beings are walking around here in the middle world. And then there's also a lower world, which is includes the amphibious creatures like the frogs and the snakes and the fish and kind of a watery underworld. And the role of human beings was to keep balance between this upper world and lower world. And so I think in this story we see that this creature from the underworld is trying to attack the sun in the upper world, and it's human beings' jobs to chase that away. And so I would like to point out that this tradition always worked. The giant frog was always chased away.
So David's prediction that maybe this is some good will come of this is borne out even in other cultures as well. There's also, Barbara, another myth about the sun and the red bird. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. This is so fascinating. And this is like one of the ancient Greek myths. It's a really long, involved, complex story. But it's about the sun. And in Cherokee mythology, the sun was a woman. Because the Cherokees, they believed in a creator, but they believed that the sun represented the creator. And they thought of the sun as a woman because they observed that the sun gave life to everything. The sun gave life to the plants, and animals ate the plants, and people eat the plants and animals. And so the sun is the life giver, and they also observed that women are the givers of life, right, by giving birth. And so this long story about the sun and her daughter, and in this long myth, at one point, the sun goes dark, and it's because she's grieving for her daughter who has been killed. And so the Cherokee sends seven men to bring her daughter back from the underworld, and they're given the magical means to do this. So they're bringing her daughter back from the land of the dead, and they have her in a box. And they've been instructed not to let her out, no matter what. But she pleads and cries, and they resist for a while, but finally they lift the lid of the box, and a red bird flies out. It's the cardinal. It's the first cardinal. It's the origin of the cardinal. And so when Cherokee storytellers tell this story, then it's kind of puzzling. Like, it's a very long, involved myth. When we talked to someone who'd been in the path of totality, he was talking about one of the things that happens during totality. In addition to seeing the corona, you can see these red kind of tongues of fire, these solar prominences that shoot out from the surface of the sun around the edge. And they are the brightest, brightest red you can imagine. And so when I heard this, I thought, oh, this is what the myth is about. It's talking about, it's alerting people to look for this bright red thing that flies out that is associated with the sun. And so to me, this myth is kind of encoding knowledge that the Cherokees knew that future generations would need, even though they maybe only observed this every 100 years or a couple hundred years still, for cultures with oral traditions, the myths and legends are ways of incorporating knowledge and passing on knowledge that people need to have.
Would the stories be told regularly or only around events like this?
Some of the stories were told on really special occasions and were considered really sacred knowledge. So they were passed on, to survive today, they had to be passed on from generation to generation. So they were told frequently enough to survive over time.
You talked about the sun having a female aspect or being understood as female in the Cherokee tradition, also understood as a kind of a trinity. Am I right about that?
Yes. What the old people say is that the creator made everything, that the sun is the representative of the creator in the sky, and that here on earth, the fire represents the sun, and that each of us has a little spark of that, of the creator in us, because we are warm.
Is there, do you know about the tradition in terms of celebrations? I mean, obviously, when we were talking about making some noise and chasing away the frog that had swallowed the sun as a kind of a thing you do, but what about formal ceremonies around an eclipse? Do we know when these began as formal ceremonies, or are they more recent?
We really don't know. There were some observers in the 1700s. James Adair happened to be in the Cherokee country when there was a total eclipse, and he said that people just kind of went crazy making loud noises, and at that point they had guns, shooting off guns. Of course, we won't be doing that here in Cherokee on Monday, but they beat on drums and made noises until the eclipse began to pass.
Michael, tell us more about the specific particular events that you have planned this next week, Sunday and Monday.
There's going to be a couple of different bands providing live music at different points throughout both of the days. And then also the Warriors of Onigadua will be sharing our traditional dances there as well. And in addition to that, myself and also Jarrett Wildcat will be sharing some of our cultural stories from the oral tradition.
Go ahead and finish that.
Sure. I believe we also have some other events in addition to the ones that I mentioned as well.
And anything in particular that happens during especially the few moments of totality or near totality? I think you'd be at 99% up in that part of the world.
I think during the time of the totality, there will be a drum group drumming and people will have noisemakers on the ground. So during that totality, people will be making noise. In contrast to up the road at the Okolowski Visitor Center at the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, they will have quiet viewing. But here at the fairgrounds and museum, people will be making noise to chase away the giant frog. And when the total eclipse passes, then the Warriors of Onigadua will come out and they will be doing their war dance, which is the dance of victory. And so it's celebrating the victory of chasing away the giant frog.
I want to thank all of you or both of you for being on the program, Barbara Duncan and Michael Crow. Mike is the Cherokee Friends Manager. Barbara is the Education Director at the Museum of Cherokee Indian in Cherokee, North Carolina. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
Also with us was David Barron, author of the new book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. David, good to talk with you.
Thank you, Frank. I hope you have clear skies again across the entire Carolinas on Monday.
Very good. Thank you very much, David. The museum events planned for the eclipse start at 2 o'clock on Sunday. You can find that information at our website. You can also find a link to David's book and other events and details that we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.